Hello, this is the fifth Napoleon movie quarter hourly miniseries episode. You need to know, if you haven't for some reason listened to the first four, go and listen to the first four. But if you haven't, I haven't seen the film. I'm watching it in 5-minute increments daily, and we're talking about it, me and this guy, James Topham. He's a screenwriter. He knows a thing or two about screenwriting. He'll tell me good things and bad things, and I'll also tell him, well, maybe good opinions and bad opinions, depending on how you perceive them, James.
Thank you, Alex, for that wonderful introduction. It's so good to be here again.
Okay. I have strong views this time, James. Really strong views. I've been negative about the first 15 minutes, negative about the second, then positive, and now very much back to negative again. Oh, I'm just going to say, I'm not happy at all. If I wave my hand, I wish you to pause so that I can insert a negative comment.
Okay, all right. I'm prepared.
Well, good then. Then let us proceed.
All right, so let's dive in. So do you remember, Alex, where we were as the hour mark ticked over at, leading us into the 50 minutes we're going to talk about?
I do. It's a really good line, and I don't mean Napoleon's emotional, "What about the boats?" or whatever he said.
"You think you're so good because you have boats."
Yeah, it's a bad line. But I loved the shot of the British ambassador, Lord Whitworth, turning his head away in such a spectacularly camp fashion and saying, "'Tis pity such a great man has such bad manners."
Yes. So we're after Napoleon's outburst, and, he goes for solace to, I believe, your favourite character, Alex, who is, of course, the butler from the recent motion picture Saltburn.
Otherwise known as Charles-Maurice Talleyrand du Périgord.
Yep. So Saltburn butler first plays on Napoleon's concerns that he's seen as a bit of a Corsican thug, in his words. And then, Alex, he suggests something extraordinary, that Napoleon renounces his title of consul to become an illustrious consul or some such thing, or, as Saltburn butler puts it, helpfully for us all to understand, the king.
Well, I wanted to ask you about this, James, because obviously you don't have a clue about anything to do with Napoleon. So when you were watching this in the cinema, presumably you'd have thought back to Julian Rhind-Tutt, who played Sieyès, who had encouraged Napoleon to engineer this coup several seconds ago. I mean, it was not long ago.
I mean, I'm flabbergasted, Alex. He's been consul for approximately 3 minutes, but here we are. He's renouncing his consulship to become king. Not necessarily, I'd say, out of ambition, but I feel because of the way that people see him. Do you know what I mean? I feel like Saltburn butler is saying, look, surely the English will take you seriously if you become king.
Okay, well, I'm so cynical about the whole thing. Just so very cynical. I feel emotions that are very deep: anger, frustration, rage, and they are clouding my perception of the screenwriting art, which you're here to help me with, I suppose, if you say so, although I partly don't care.
So look, as is often the case, Napoleon doesn't say anything at the end of the scene. He just sort of takes this on. But as we've found in this film, screenwriting rule: if someone suggests something in a prior scene, it immediately happens. And look, Napoleon's keen. He's obviously buoyed up by this suggestion that he become king, and he returns to Josephine, which I'm very happy about. Good to see Josephine back in this film, but not as happy as Napoleon is to see her. Alex, I don't know, obviously you've been doing your Joaquin Phoenix impressions as we've been going through the podcast. Can you give us a bit of a rendition of how he reacts on seeing Josephine?
Yeah, I thought we could start the episode with this, but I forgot. It's like it's the start of a great symphony, isn't it? That starts very slowly. Dum, 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 dum. It's like an engine slowly revving its way up. And he's pouring the ground as he does so. And soon he's going to be into full wacky races.
Yes, yes. He's nomming like no one's nommed before. And it does take, I would say, a good 3 or 4 seconds for us to realise that this is an expression of sexual attraction. up to that point, it's entirely impossible to understand what is going on.
There was a moment of genuine bewilderment, which is a par for the course for this film, it seems. But no, yes, there's the look from the two ladies in waiting, or whatever they are, and they make a swift exit, and it's clear that it's time for everybody to hold on to their hats.
Yes, and boy, do they hold on to their hats. So despite Josephine's protestations that she's just had her hair set, Napoleon has no care for that, and they get to, I suppose there's only one way of putting it, Alex, rutting.
It is rutting, isn't it? It's fast, it's animalistic. It's animalistic in the sense of being devoid of emotion, it seems, again.
Yes, because this is rutting without, or it's rather rutting with a cause, Alex, because we find in the next scene at breakfast, firstly, Napoleon comes in. He and Josephine seem to be in a good mood. There's a callback to the chair moving scene. I don't know if you remember the quite iconic chair moving scene of their first date, Alex.
I certainly do, and the screeching sound it made on the floor, absolutely. But I suppose it's the same with all activities. It's the difference between doing something because you want to do it and doing something because you feel like you have to do it, or you ought to do it. It's a big difference.
A bit like this podcast for me, Alex. I think that that it's very interesting that there's a change in the dynamic of this chair moving, because whilst Napoleon, you know, starts off in a kind of a jokey romantic manner, he does have an axe to grind, as it were, with Josephine, because she, it turns out, is not pregnant. Why, he asks.
Why? Well, she attempts an explanation. But the medicos haven't come up with the goods, have they?
No. But I think, you know, I think what we whatever reasons they had for the previous rutting, it's very clear that now that he has become king, or now that he has kingship on the horizon, Napoleon is interested in an heir.
Now, this is in fact the case. Kingship does require an heir. But it's, I think, something that grows slowly on him, this preoccupation. But I suppose it's being accelerated here into the very next thought that pops into his head.
Yeah, look, we don't have time to be, you know, for things to grow, for thoughts to grow. We need to dive straight into it. But look, I think he and Josephine are still on good terms, demonstrated by Napoleon disappearing under the table and in silhouette crawling towards Josephine, grunting like a pig, Alex?
Yeah, I was going to say like a wild boar.
Oh, yeah. No, I thought you were going to do your Napoleon impression. It wasn't great, but it was...
No, it's lower, isn't it?
It was interesting. It was from the soul.
It's like... There you go.
Yeah, that's very good. Very good. And Napoleon pulls Josephine under the table for, we assume, another bout of lovemaking. And Vanessa Kirby's delivery of her "Oh God," which suggests a tiredness beyond human capacity, is excellent.
They don't pay her the big bucks for nothing.
But look, we've got to keep going, Alex. We've got to keep pushing through this film, and we go onwards to 1804 and the coronation. How do we know it's the coronation, Alex?
Well, the screenwriter has written coronation on the screen in the usual big letters.
Useful and helpful. Interestingly, the camera is focusing perhaps more on Josephine than Napoleon as they walk down the aisle, not the least because she picks out in her crowd her ex-lover for what feels like years, but is actually only a few moments of screen time ago. What do you think about this sudden appearance of the ex-lover, Alex?
Well, I like the way that he doesn't bow to her like all of the others. You know, they're really impressed, but he's thinking, having engaged with you carnally, I don't think that applies to me. And so that is uncomfortable for her, because her past, as was established fairly early on, is checkered, but it's something that she's keen to move beyond. There's tension. There's real tension there.
Mm, there really is. There really is. But after that brief kind of moment, we do kind of move to Napoleon, who reaches the front of the palace where the crown is waiting for him, along with a shouty little man who, I guess from the outfit, is perhaps the Pope, Alex. I don't know if this is a moment for a history check.
Yeah, I can confirm it is the Pope. The subtitles on Amazon Prime also said the Pope, which helped. But here we are once again. This is the history book which I'm using as the historical source for this 10-episode miniseries, The Story of Napoleon, A Ladybird Adventures from History Book. It's for children. It was written by Eldugard Peach in 1968. Eldugard Peach wrote, "The Pope came to Paris to crown the new emperor, but at the supreme moment of the ceremony, Napoleon took the crown from the hands of the Pope. None but Napoleon was fitted to crown Napoleon. By this he signified to the world that he owed the crown to his own efforts and to none other." Very grandiose language, wouldn't you say, James?
I would indeed. I would indeed. And it's a grandiose moment, I think, in the film, Alex, because that precisely is what happens. Napoleon, instead of waiting for the Pope to do the business, plucks up the crown himself. And he says, I don't know if you've got the line, Alex. He says, "I found the crown of France in the gutter. I picked it up with the tip of my sword and cleaned it off." Whoa, pretty strong stuff.
It's stage managed, isn't it? But actually, this film might have accidentally made a good point here by dwelling on the coronation, that great moment of spectacle, because a lot of Napoleon's rule was about PR and being an excellent comms person, essentially. And here he is doing it in such magnificent and magnificently effective fashion.
Mm. I also wonder whether it says something about the characterization that's growing in terms of Napoleon as a protagonist, because he's someone who is plucking up his destiny, if you will, rather than waiting for it to come to him. And I wonder whether that's something we'll see more of.
Well, I'm not happy with this, James. I'm not happy with what you're saying. Because if that was the case, why didn't we have something at the start of Act One about destiny that was much more powerful, something that we could actually recall and remember? I don't think there was anything where he really talked about destiny. He wasn't portrayed as somebody who was a visionary who was pursuing this great opportunity that life was giving him. He was just somebody in those early minutes of the film who was appalled by animal cruelty to the horse he was riding on, and did quite well at sneaking around as a spy. And being bewildered and confused by the French Revolution. But there wasn't much about destiny. So the mummy, I suppose, in Egypt, that was a bit of destiny foreshadowing, but that was about it.
Well, I wonder whether we're seeing a development in his character, right? You know, I mean, I think early on in that first act, we saw him taking opportunities that were put in his path. But now more and more we're seeing him take things into his own hands. And that may be a good thing for him. It may be his downfall.
Okay, well, obviously I appreciate your screenwriting nous and will accept that. Also, partly because I can... Well, partly I accept it because I can see how that could develop quite interestingly as he becomes fatter, essentially.
Well, look, I think we may be jumping ahead. I think there's some very interesting destiny stuff in a few scenes' time. But before that, we are back with Creepy Butler from Saltburn.
Talleyrand, Foreign Minister.
He's whispering poison in Napoleon's ear. No sooner has he suggested that he become king, he's now got another plot, which is divorce. Napoleon needs an heir, so Saltburn Butler says, and the entire peace and prosperity of the world might rely on it, and Josephine isn't coming up with the goods.
I like the portrayal of Talleyrand as this serpent-tongued, oily chappy who has the ear of the emperor, which is pretty much how it was. So I like that a lot. And he it's fine. He can serve this purpose, be the vehicle who pushes Napoleon towards divorce, even if it's coming, feels a little bit sooner rather than later.
Well, as is often the case, it's been suggested, so we've got to get on with it, Alex. That night, it feels like, Napoleon and Josephine are at dinner with a whole crowd of people, we should say, and they have an extremely awkward conversation, entirely devoid of subtext, one might note from a screenwriting point of view.
And why is that, James?
Well, sometimes we like to use subtext to draw an audience in, to give a sense of multi-layered characters. We don't have time for that, Alex. We need to get to the meat of what these two people are talking about. And the
which meat, James?
Well, look, we're not there yet. Look, Napoleon says he needs an heir. Josephine says he's not up to it in the bedroom. They're trading insults. She calls Napoleon fat, which leads, I think, to what you're referring to, Alex, which I would say is a classic Napoleonism.
I'd say it was a classic Trumpism.
Oh.
Because it's a shoulder shrug. I enjoy my food. It was about that then. That wasn't really Trump, but you get the point.
I do. So he says, I like my food. I do like it. Destiny brought me here, Alex. Destiny has brought me to this lamb chop. What could it mean?
So there we go. We really are getting to the meat of this scene.
Could it be hubris, Alex? That's my thought. Napoleon's greatness, is starting to eat itself. You know, he's just like Napoleon will eat that lamb chop. He's sort of like he assumes that he's so great that even kind of quotidian normal things that come along his plate are the stuff of destiny.
I hate to say it, but it reminds me of the Beatles in the late 60s when they thought anything they could put out would sell. Those avant-garde early solo albums were not that good, but they honestly thought they could do it. And obviously, okay, this analogy falls down because Napoleon doesn't have a great solo career after 1815, but I'd say that but Napoleon is somebody who but
have
Napoleon,
you have you had a stroke, Alex? Are you
I got a bit stuck.
Look, I think we can all agree that Napoleon is very much like the Beatles of the late 60s. Okay, look.
I don't think there'll be any more Beatles analogies in this podcast.
Yeah, we can only hope, Alex. So look, the argument defends into a brief food fight. Josephine runs off sort of stage left. But later Napoleon comes to Josephine and apologises. He says that he'll miss her when he's off at war.
James, I can't believe you just skipped past the food fight so quickly. That is a key moment, isn't it? We've seen cannonballs fly and now we're seeing lamb chops fly. That just seems like a really important... I wouldn't go so far as to say it's a motif, but flying things implies danger in this film. Surely, is that not the case?
It's remarkable that he didn't cover his ears when that lamb chop took off, Alex.
And what about his mother? The shot of his mother, we need to talk about that as well.
I think I completely missed the shot of his mother. Was his mother at dinner?
Absolutely, she was.
Jesus.
She winces that the camera is on her when Napoleon Bonaparte says, and there were others too, in terms of people who his wife has copulated with during their marriage, and she does a little eyeballs rolling to the top of her head and shakes her head as if to go, oh!
Well, I can't believe I've missed a Napoleon mother spot. That is
that
is negligent of me. All right, so they the end of this, I suppose, is that Napoleon isn't ready to throw Josephine over, and he's off to war. And my God, Alex, I think this might be Austerlitz.
Yes, I think you're right.
I don't know if you want to do a history check. At this point, there's snow, there's ice.
Well, let's see.
There's Cossacks. Could it be Austerlitz?
Hang on. I'm just having a look in the only historical source we're using, which seems to be obsessed with Trafalgar, which obviously isn't mentioned at all. Gosh, it just goes on. Hang on. So Austerlitz is not covered in this book, I think. So I'm going to have to rely on my own memory when I tell you that, yeah, I think it was quite snowy at Austerlitz.
So Napoleon is walking through the snow. He's in a sort of peasant garb, looking through a spyglass in a scene a little reminiscent, I would say, of Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back. I don't know if you saw that that reference, that allusion.
Yeah, I saw that movie, and it seems surprising to me that Sir Ridley Scott didn't think, hang on, wouldn't it be great if we could get those laser blasters and have them pew-pew-pewing at each other instead of boring old muskets?
I don't want to spoil it for you. I think this is in the next episode, Alex, but there's stuff that's happening in Austerlitz that you would not expect.
No, come on.
And then, so he's spying on, and we find out who he's spying on. It's Tsar Alexander and Francis of Austria. Francis of Austria, played in a sudden and explosive appearance by Miles Jupp, another stalwart of the British comedy scene.
My response was, Miles Jupp?
he's having a great crack at an Austrian accent as well. He's a real trooper, that man.
So you're saying it was Napoleon spying? Because that was the face inside the shadowy, cloaked...
Oh,
telescope,
yeah.
Obscured. Yeah, that was him.
I do think so. But what's interesting here, I think, from a screenwriting perspective, Alex, is how long it's been since we've had a scene that hasn't had the commanding presence of Napoleon at its centre.
Is that right?
It feels like a long time.
Yeah, I suppose you're right. Yeah, okay.
That's, so why might the screenwriters suddenly have this kind of break from this single perspective, Alex, do you think?
Maybe they forgot
that Napoleon was in the film.
Well, that's the name of the film. And so that would help them go on a good run, but everyone's human. Everyone makes mistakes.
Yeah, maybe. But also maybe it's to a kind of, I suppose, give the audience a break, but also establish this kind of other side of the world. Because I think, I suspect that Miles Jupp and the Tsar Alexander may come back at a later point.
Yeah, I had been giving this some thought because, and different ways you could have done this film. Because who are the adversaries? Who are the antagonists who will be taking on the protagonist? That's surely screenwriting pitter-patter, is that right?
It certainly is screenwriting pitter-patter of the highest order.
Oh, well, there we go. I'm learning. But are the British a sufficient antagonist? Yes, they swore at some goats early on, and that's something. And we will return to the British inevitably because of Waterloo. But maybe it's the British that are the hook that start and end this film. But for the meat in the sandwich, you need a different antagonist. And because of 1812 and more snow coming up, it would make sense to go with the Russians, to go with the Tsar, I suppose, for the middle of this film as the main antagonist. And antagonists are allowed to go on their own character journeys as well. Is that fair to say, James?
Oh, absolutely. Often they mirror the journeys of the protagonist in order to better illustrate the protagonist's journey.
Interesting. Do you think that's what's going to happen here?
Well, if they focus a little bit, but I suspect they may get distracted by something else. But it is notable that, and we get this in classic wartime voiceover from Napoleon, he talks about the Tsar as kind of a young child, but also that he was an erstwhile ally who turned on him, but who's copying his tactics. Of course, what those tactics are, the film hasn't told us yet. Perhaps it's getting hold of the big guns. But even Napoleon himself seems to suggest that the Tsar may be some sort of a kind of mirror image of him, a younger, more popular version of himself.
And no one likes that, the upcoming rival that means you, basically, yeah, you were the future once, but no longer.
Yeah, exactly. So look, we're careering towards the 1 hour 15 minutes. There's the beginnings of what feels like preparations for a battle. Soldiers are knocking ice off forts. There's some kind of ludicrous communication devices, flashes of lamps, which are able to communicate kind of long and complex pieces of information.
What? How much directing do you think those actors had? That was their part. And obviously they do it in a very quick, rapid way. It's very jerky. It looks really, really weird initially. And
yeah.
But I suppose that it's almost a metaphor for the film itself, isn't it? They're kind of going to completely unnaturally yoink themselves up and down so drastically that it won't bear any resemblance to anything actual. Oh dear.
Yes. I think the extras flashing these lamps are trying really hard with a difficult hand played to them. I think the extras working these lamps are doing very well with a difficult hand that's been dealt to them.
Let's hope that their movie careers aren't flash in the pans. Oh no, that's anachronism. Never mind, carry on.
The complex information that has been communicated to one of Napoleon's aides is that Napoleon's camp has been discovered. The aide runs desperately to inform Napoleon of this bad news, and Napoleon, cool as a cucumber, responds, "Good." As they would say in Star Wars, Alex, it's a trap.
It's a ruse de guerre.
It is a ruse de guerre. It's the rusiest guerre you could possibly think of. And it's a trap that's soon to be sprung, because through further long-distance communication, this time with flags, don't know why they swapped communication devices, but they did. Napoleon's informed that the infantry are on their way. Imminent!
They're behind you.
They're behind you. It's the best line of the 15 minutes. And just as we're hitting 1 hour 15, here they come, the Russians, through the snow.
So an exciting moment again for us to pause.
We're really on a cliffhanger here, coming into the next episode.
God, what an ordeal watching this film is. I found this 15 minutes really, really tough. It was just so frustrating, every scene, apart from Talleyrand, who's great.
You just want every scene to be in, you know, diplomatic chat. That's what your interest is, Alex, diplomatic chat.
I suppose the rutting, or rather the bits around the rutting, were humorous in an absurdist mode. But it does seem to be fairly all over the place, this film. It's got a bit of comedy, a bit of pathos. Has it, though? Has it? Oh, God. How can we possibly do 5 more episodes on this? Well, I suppose...
Look, we're halfway there, Alex. Think of it that way.
Hang on a second. If we're halfway there, that's surely significant in terms of the three-act film structure, surely.
There's no way we're at the midpoint, Alex. No way. Although, maybe next episode. It depends how significant the battle is that is forthcoming.
It's quite important. But, okay, maybe that's for the next episode. Can you just remind us once again, or maybe just remind me, what Act 2 is all about in general, particularly the first half of Act 2? Maybe by applying that test to what I've just seen, it might make me feel better about it.
So the first part of Act 2 is about the promise of the premise. So it's laying out, what do you come to see a film called Napoleon to see?
Okay, well...
And it's a little bit of sexiness, a little bit of battles, a little bit of him becoming king. So I think that's fair.
It did tick that box, didn't it, actually?
And it's about advances and setbacks.
Okay, well, it's the Russians that are advancing, but it's Napoleon advancing up the aisle to get coronated. So it's a mixture, yeah.
Yeah, it's a mixture. Yeah, yeah. Advances, he becomes consul, he becomes king. Setbacks, he nearly gets beaten up by those deputies. Yeah. A bit of a setback.
Oh, that was Act 2 as well, was it? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. No children.
Which is a big ongoing setback. So here we are then. I've been frustrated as a Napoleon movie watcher, but by showing me the light in terms of the screenwriting logic, you've explained why what I'm watching is the way it is. So does it make me feel better about it? I'm not sure. I'll have to think about it.
Well, we've got another 1 hour 50 minutes to come to that conclusion, I guess.
Only 5. So in the main, James, you won't even know this because, of course, you wouldn't listen to the Napoleonic Quarterly, although I recommend it. But we count down the number of days to go until the end of Waterloo. Until Waterloo. at the end of each episode. So there's like, you know, where I've got to now, there's about 3,900 days until Waterloo. And I think we need to start counting down how long there's left in this film, which is just 75 minutes left to watch.
Yep. Yes, indeed.
That's how long is left. So we've got to cling on and finish what we've started, because otherwise we're not going to achieve what's been brought to us by destiny.
Pork chop.
Pork chop, lamb chop, whatever it might be, James, I will throw it at you.